Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Work in Digital Humanities, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. My name is Luca Scholz. I'm a lecturer in digital humanities at the University of Manchester. And this is a new series that I'm setting up together with several colleagues to create a forum to discuss new books and book-length projects that have a substantial digital component from across the humanities. Today, I talk with Marcin Wojcinski and with Waldemar Spalek. Marcin Wojcinski is a professor of Jewish history and literature at the University of Wrocław in Poland. Some people might know the city as Breslau. He heads the Department of Jewish Studies there, and he published widely on the social history of the Jews in the 19th century, on the history of the Jews in Silesia and Jewish material culture, and in particular on the history of Hasidism. Marcin received countless distinctions and served as the, among other things, as the chief historian for the Museum of the History of Polish Jews in Warsaw. Waldemar Spalek is a assistant professor of geographic information systems and cartography at the University of Wrocław. He worked on a wide range of projects in cartography and geographic information science, including work that involved unmanned aerial vehicles and temperature data. Together, they created the Historical Atlas of Hasidism. It's the first cartographic reference book on one of modernity's most vibrant and important mystical movements. It's a spatial history of a movement that has often been understood as aterritorial. It uses 74 large format maps and a wealth of illustrations and charts to show how geography has influenced the social organization of Hasidism, its spiritual life, different types of religious leaderships, and its culture. It's also a social history in some ways, because it focuses not only on Hasidic leaders, but also on their thousands of followers who lived far from the Hasidic centers. So welcome, Marcin and Waldemar.
Hello.
Hello.
So to start off, I would like to ask you, what brought you to this project?
May I start?
Yeah.
Waldemar, is this okay?
Yes, it's okay.
That actually two phenomena that you already mentioned. One was my long-time interest in Hasidism. This might be called an offspring of my research 12 years project on key questions in Hasidism that I started in 2007. And one of the questions was about the space. And another issue that emerged kind of simultaneously was my work as head historian for the Polish Museum of the History of Polish Jews in Warsaw, when on the stage of preparation, I was responsible, among others, for the exhibition on Hasidism, on religious life in general, and Hasidism in particular. And there I was faced with a major question for the museum: how to show development of Hasidism, not to tell about it, but to communicate it to visitors who are not ready to read and believe. They need to see it. And there, the first idea that came to my mind was to map Hasidic expansion across Eastern Europe. But then I realized there's not such a map. And that was the first map that ended up as chapter 2 of our atlas. But from this concept, how to see and how to turn a concept that we have in textual forms into something that can be visible, the atlas emerged.
Interesting. Right. So how did you meet Valdemar? How did he get involved in the project?
So one day I received an email from Martin and from Professor Martin Wodziński, because I don't know him, and he sent me a proposition to make some maps on history of Hasidism, of history of Judaism, and about on contemporary Hasidism. It was very interesting for me because I am a geographer, but my hobby is history of Poland, history of the world, and history of Judaism, especially of Polish Jews. So I agree, and I was in.
Mm-hmm. On my side, if I may say, it was very simple. I was shopping around who is the best cartographer in the area. And of all of those, several names appeared actually, but only one was in Wrocław, available at the university, so I turned to him. As simple as this.
Thank you very much.
So what would you say are the key contributions of this atlas?
Key contributions is a difficult question. I would, first of all, I'm not sure that everybody that listens to this podcast know what Hasidism really is.
Right. Yeah.
So maybe we should start with this.
Yeah, sure.
Hasidism is a religious movement that emerged in Judaism in the second half of the 18th century, and throughout the 19th century became kind of uniquely a mystical movement that is at the same time a dominant form of religious life of the biggest Jewish community worldwide, which was the Jewish community in Eastern Europe. This is one of maybe two such world phenomena that a mystical movement, which is elitist by nature, manages to conquer the vast share of the population that becomes really a popular form of religiosity, maybe with Sufism, right? A tool of such. And what is even more important, with time, Hasidism managed to position itself as the embodiment of traditional Judaism. Today, for many people who'd never heard the name of Hasidism, when they are asked what is a Jew, how a Jew looks like, they would give you the description of a Hasid, a person in a fur hat, in a black capota, with white stockings. So description of a Hasid. So in this sense, Hasidism became kind of an icon of Jewishness,
yeah,
and of Judaism, or at least traditional Judaism. In this sense, until now, it occupies a central position in Jewish life. And this is possibly the most popular topic of Jewish studies worldwide. Except for the Holocaust, of course. There is huge interest into this, but at the same time, there is a concept of Hasidism being aterritorial, or actually Judaism being aterritorial, which I take to be totally wrong. And the concept was, if we can visualize with maps the expansion of Hasidism, what can we learn about this movement? What can we learn? And that was my boldest statement. What can we learn about correlation between space and spirituality? And the number of maps is trying to trace what is correlation, how the space influences spirituality, and how spirituality informs the spatial development of the movement. At the same time, one of important innovations of this atlas in study of Hasidism and in study of Judaism more generally was a turn from elitist to egalitarian perspective. A dominant trend in researching Hasidism, as many other religious movements, or from 19th century, as much of history in general, is to focus on the leaders, which is for many reasons is easier, it's more attractive, the sources are readily available.
Yeah.
But my contention is that Hasidism is so important exactly because it became mass movement. So this egalitarian aspect of Hasidism is at the center for me of interest. And instead of mapping the Hasidic leaders only, I tried to put at least equal attention on hundreds of thousands of rank and file Hasidim worldwide to put into this map. I think this is something that changes our perception of Hasidism in general. It's something that is also kind of new for geography of religion and history of religion more generally, I believe, because we also managed to make an atlas that is kind of unique in presenting kind of mesoscale of thinking about religion and its history. We have a lot of atlases of religion, but mostly they use census data that present us kind of macro images. In macro images of continents, of countries, with distinction by millions of followers of different religions, you don't see people behind it. On the other hand, we have a lot of micro studies, but in micro studies, it's sometimes difficult to project importance of those micro studies on something that is bigger than individual. And I believe that our atlas manages to hit into the mesoscale research that is kind of human scale. We see movement from the perspective of individuals. We see how individual prayer sites were located within wider panorama of Hasidic prayer sites. We see how individual Hasidic leaders are moving from place to place and how it influences religious practices of the hundreds and thousands of their followers, and on and on. And I would say this is equally important for the study of Hasidism, but also for the study of religion more generally.
That is definitely something that comes through in the atlas. I mean, this is pretty much a first. There are not this, in a sense, this is pioneering work, right? This is not something there are not a lot of maps of Hasidism before the work that you published.
Very few indeed, and I think that the maps are innovative not only in comparison to other maps of Hasidism, but also to many maps of religion in general. And I think Waldemar could say a bit more about it.
Yes, I think that it's the key contribution from my point of view is that the maps are one of the first which shows a history, historical movement, social history, not only history as a changing of border of countries, but history of people. It says one group of people, Hasidism, Hasids, but I think that this map could be implemented in other fields of historical research, and this map could be a good solution for other other research, like history of nation, history of other religious group, history of social group, and so on.
Right. So, in a sense, a model for other, for other fields. I would agree. I think, especially some of the.
You can hear we are quite proud of this atlas, right?
Yeah, you should
be. We are very proud.
You should be. I think it's very. I mean, in many senses, also you really see that you really experimented quite a bit, also with different forms of data visualization, right? I mean, maybe we can. So, since we're talking about the maps, let's talk a bit. I would be curious to hear how you made those maps. So how you collected the data, but then also how the cartographic work worked. I mean, where does this data come from?
Okay, so I would speak about the data, and maybe Waldemar would speak more about how we made those maps from the data sets that we had. I believe this is also kind of encouraging for people who think that digital humanities are not for them, that digital humanities require high technical IT skills or computer skills in general. The data for the maps and essential concepts for the maps came from my historical research, and all of this was low tech. In a sense, it was a kind of analog research. It wasn't with a pencil, it was with Excel files or other office stuff, but it's very simple technical equipment. Most of the data were collected from variety of sources. They are available, and this is something that, again, I think something very important and kind of innovative in this map, that this kind of resources exist and are available for research. People say, one example, contemporary sociologists were arguing for decades already why it is impossible to count how many Hasidim live today. And they give many good reasons, and all those reasons are legitimate.
Right.
But it's only if you assume that the list of resources for counting them is limited to the resources they listed. And I suggested we can go into very different source base. In this case, it was internal Hasidic telephone directories. Mm. And it's not easy source because it's thousands of pages of internal materials that are usually not available for outsiders. So I had to convince Hasidim within each group to donate or borrow a copy for me, for my use, and I had to use my students to digest information about each individual household from those telephone directories and to put it into the Excel file. As an effect, we have a database of 130,000 Hasidim worldwide, Hasidic families, sorry, worldwide today. And it's a huge database. It allows us to count with the unmatched precision, not only how many Hasidim there are today in general terms, but with zip codes for each of those families, we can pin them to very specific places. What is more, we can divide them into subgroups that Hasidism is divided, because telephone directories are issued not for Hasidim as such, but Hasidic groups within Hasidic movement. So we can say that this is a Satmar Hasid, this is Lubavitcher Hasid, this is Gerer Hasid, and we can tell, for example, how many of Lubavitcher Hasidim live in Kronhausen and how many of them live in Borough Park. And we can say with very precise information about hierarchies of those groups, size of those groups, how they mix, where they live and where they do not live. For example, none of the Satmar Hasidim would living in the occupied territories, while at the same time, some groups have as many as 10% of the Hasidim living in those territories, and on and on. So you can not only map, but you can also understand structures from those data. As I'm saying, it's very simple. It's just telephone directories.
Huh. How long?
And this is only one. It is the biggest one, but only one of types of sources. The other one that I'm very proud of is 2,854 Hasidic prayer sites at the beginning of the 20th century across all of Eastern Europe. And this required me actually months and months of work going through Hasidic memorial books, Pinkasim, which is kind of record books, Hebrew and Yiddish press, recollections, collections of subscription books, and on and on. It was many months of work, but what came out is, again, something that is unmatched in research on Hasidism, because today we can tell very clearly what was the hierarchy of groups, what was the strength, what was the geographical distribution of individual Hasidic groups, what were interrelations between them, and on and on. And several other of the, such databases were used for this map. What is important, none of those databases existed before the atlas was created. They were created for the use of this atlas.
Right, so that is all. How long did that take you to collect all that data?
It was, as I was telling you, this was 12 years project, so I had enough time to do it.
Right. Okay, so at that point you had the data. How did you transform those then into maps? Can you tell us something about that?
Before it comes to you, I would like to add one sentence. I collected this data because I had a research question, right? So this is not a blind data. That was I had a problem that I wanted to resolve, and I thought that this information would allow us to see and understand a phenomenon at question, right? So I came to Valdemar with a data set and a question, and there was his work. Valdemar, it's you now.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and
asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, the first step for me, it was to give to this data an a space. It means that Marcin gave me a big Excel database, and there was only a names for this place, and I have to search where the place is, and take them geographical coordinates. It was in a most of them are rather easy, because it was names which was familiar for me, but a few of them was a name for places which no longer exist, and the name was wrote in Yiddish, as I presume, and or in Jewish language, in Hebrew, yeah, Hebrew or Yiddish, but in Hebrew alphabet. So we don't know what is the name for this place now, or what was the name in the previous time. For example, it was Pereyaslavl. It's a town near to the Kiev, which was wrote as a Preslav or something like that. We consider what this place is, and we agree that it may be this Pereyaslav. So when we when I give this geographical coordinates, it was easy to take this to the geographical information system ArcGIS by S3, and in this program I made maps. I designed maps using a typical cartographical method, and for many of maps, I and Marcin, we not discover, but we make a new, cartographical techniques, cartographical methods to visualize this data. For example, there was a problem how to show on maps a development of Hasidic or Tzadik dynasties. It means that one Hasidic leader, Tzadik, lived in one town, and he has a son or sons, and they sometimes live in the same time, in the same town. Sometimes they go to the other town and establish a new branch of this dynasty. So how to show how long he existed in this town, and what is his connection with other people from this dynasty. Maybe it is he is a son, maybe he is a grandson, maybe he is a friend of Tzadik. And we designed this map. There was a very many solutions, many no good solutions, but the first critics of our maps was wife of Marcin, who told us this map is good or this map is bad. Bad means that the map is not readable for, not maybe not readable, it is not understand what the map shows, what the map shows. So if Marcin Weiss said that the map is understandable, we have to change our visualization. Another problem was how what colors we can use for visualization of data, especially the contrast between point and line signs to aerial signs or background. It is Marcin's idea, and I think it's a very good idea, and a big thank you for you, Marcin, that the background should be a very, very, very fine, not fine, a very pale, yeah, pale, and in pastel color. I don't know how to speak English. Pastelowy, pastel, yeah, pastel colors. And the main theme of maps, it means which are show in point and line signs, should be in a very clear and saturated colors, like red, yellow, green, purple, or something like that. And the contrast makes that the maps are, for me, very readable or bardzo czytelne.
Readable, very readable, yeah.
Very readable.
And this is something, if I might add here, something very important to me also, because we wanted to achieve two things at the same time. The maps, as Waldemar explained to me, are either to see or to read. And rarely they meet those two agendas. And my idea was to have map, all the maps, that would have both elements at the same time, in a sense that each map would be understandable at the first sight. So I wanted to have this wow effect. You look at the map and you immediately get the main message. You don't need to understand the language of cartography, relation between maps, diagrams, scales, and on. That's one way of communicating what's the most important message of the map. But at the same time, each map we wanted to have fully saturated with deep information that after having this wow effect at the one level, you can go deeper and you can read it for long sometimes and get more nuanced information about details and on. And this is something that was very difficult. None of the maps just came as such. Each map we had to discuss. We had to use my profane amateur look on those maps and my wife's look on those maps to make sure that the maps are understandable to everybody. And thanks, Waldemar, he had enough patience to stay with us throughout all this process. It was many months of designing those maps, actually. But what comes out, people say, is not only beautiful, but also understandable.
Yeah, it's very, yeah, I'm impressed by how you managed to strike that balance, right, between fitting in a lot of information, but still having the maps fairly intuitive and easy to read. One thing I was wondering, Waldemar, you said you used ArcGIS. Did you do everything in ArcGIS, or did you also use something like, I don't know, Adobe Illustrator or other software?
Okay. First step of every maps was made in ArcGIS, because this is a program which can... which helped me to prepare or prepare this big data. But this last step to prepare maps for printing, it was made in CorelDRAW, because ArcGIS is a program for preparing map on screen, on internet. So it means that there is no special function and special tools to prepare for printing. For example, special function over black over black is always over print. It means that black color is in printing is print on paper in the last step of printing. So in program we have to check that every black elements, points, letters, words on maps should be overprint. It means that black is overprinted on yellow or cyan. Cyan is a color of ink, and on magenta. And thanks for them for that the map are a much better from technical point of view. So the last step of preparing maps I made in CorelDRAW.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. All right. So what about the reception of this book? What was your experience with how people read this? Do you think that this atlas reached a different audience than maybe your previous work?
Oh, surely it does. First of all, this is my first book with Princeton University Press, which is a global publisher, so the book reaches widely, really, but far beyond it. As I was saying, though, this is visual material, so it communicates issues that I was presenting in textual way for last 20 years or something. Now those issues can be presented in visual way, not only with maps that we discussed, but also with illustrations, charts, and tables. This atlas has 100 color illustrations. Some of them are unique, published for the first time, and also the publisher put a lot of effort to follow our requests and advice how to combine maps and illustrations so the way that they speak to each other. Before we talk, Luca, you pointed to the way how the map of the Holocaust is juxtaposed with the map of children in contemporary Hasidic community, right? So this is exactly the way how we communicate certain things in a way that is not textual. And this is one way, obviously, of communicating this. And I believe this is very successful. The Atlas is very popular within academy, but also beyond it. And this is my first time that I have such a warm reception from the Hasidic community. And maybe for the audience, I need to explain it. It's not so that they disliked me before. I was totally indifferent, because as every very traditional and anti-modernist community, the Hasidim are very suspicious of academic research on them. They don't believe, in essence, they don't believe that we have anything significant to tell them they don't know already. They believe that we are interested in kind of external aspects of their life, like social organization, economical aspects, which are not essential, that we don't understand what real religious love of the Hasidic community is. And this is very typical conflict between religious and secular communities. In Hasidism, it's very strong. In Hasidism, there's also a measure of suspicion towards non-Hasidic words, which is again an outcome of more than 100 years of secular versus religious war, as in many other communities. And now my atlas comes to this conflict, if I say so, which brings elements that are obviously unknown to the Hasidim. And this is something that even if they knew about all those locations of their leaders, they could never visualize it. So I'm telling them something that is important, that is relevant, and it's very new to them. Some of the debates about the number of Hasidim, each of them possibly knows each of the Hasidim today, I would claim, knows more or less the size of his own community, right? So people in the Satmar community might know that it is more than 100,000 people, that it's more than 26,000 Hasidic households. Or the people in Sadoguda might know that it's less than 1,000 households. So they know those sizes, but they don't know how it is situated in relation to all other families, all other Hasidic groups, and what is the geographical pattern of their life. And here they come in Atlas into the information, important information about their own group and all other groups, and they compare it and they see. And actually, I was receiving emails from people saying, oh, I see that you recorded even my own family living in this small place that nobody ever noticed there is one Hasidic family here. So people are reacting, just looking into the Atlas for looking for themselves or their ancestors or for the families and on and on. So in this sense, this is something that I think in kind of unique way managed to get into the Hasidic community with important scholarly messages. In one of Hasidic journals, there was a very extensive article about this research, about this Atlas. It was a combination of kind of reportage and interview. And most interestingly, it was in Hebrew. The article was entitled Goy Hasid, meaning a Gentile who is Hasid at the same time. So I got a title of an honorary Hasid thanks to this Atlas. I believe this is the highest appraisal of the Atlas I could ever get.
Wow.
That sounds impressive. So
I was very happy with this indeed.
That sounds very interesting. It didn't occur to me, but that sounds like a that's fairly impressive that you managed to get a reception for this within the communities themselves as well. So I mean, you mentioned at the beginning, right, that this Atlas in some ways can also be a model for other publications, right, for other people who could work maybe on the history of religion, but maybe in historical geography and spatial history more general. So what advice would you give to people who are thinking about embarking on a similar project?
Think twice. It takes 12 years to prepare it. That's first advice. I'm not good at giving advices. In a sense, this is an open field. Today with digital tools, we are in position to research things that were unavailable. Actually, it was unimaginable that we can research, and today they are at hand for us. At the same time, what was important for me with this Atlas was that this Atlas was driven by the research question and not by the source or technicalities or technical opportunities. Very often in digital humanities, we have exemplary research, which is showing what you can make of this kind of source or what you can make with this kind of tool, but they respond to no question. We are not interested in responses, simply. We never ask those questions. And here, the Atlas comes with a question of issues that we want to know, the questions that were very important at center of the study of Hasidism or of study of Jewish religious life in general. So in this sense, if I was to give advice, I would say by all means use as much of digital humanities as possible, but always start with a research question. Think what interests you and then look for tools and resources and not the other way around.
Yeah, that sounds like great advice. How about you, Valdemar? Is there something from a cartographic point of view that you would say, any advice that you would give to people?
Yes, I think that everyone who want to do this the project like ours, to do some maps on historical geography, on history more generally, if you want to do this, do this. And don't hesitate. Maybe you come up with a much better solution that we, but I think that it's a very great idea to make maps for history, because maps helps to understand what what happened in past time. Without maps, it is not simple to understand.
If I may add also issues that I think it's trivial that possibly everybody knows, but sometimes it's important things, such obvious things. What digital humanities and what the GIS changes is that the map is the beginning and not the end of the research. In a sense that maps that Waldemar presented to me from the material that I had opened to me new possibilities of understanding these materials. I had a question. I thought I knew the material, but only after the mapping, I saw what they really tell us, what they really bring, what are the information encoded. Usually when you have 130,000 families, you see the biggest centers very easily. But what's happening on this mesoscale, what's happening in mid-sized places, what's happening in a wider plane, you can never get by just the eye view. You need to map it, and only then you understand the patterns. And this is something that was critical to me in this atlas. We started with maps. We also ended with them, but those maps that we presented in the atlas are very different from what we started. And that's the best proof to me that mapping is really something that provides entirely new understanding into history.
So for you, this was a way of doing research. It was not presenting something you already knew. It was really exploring.
And I think this is typical for GIS in general. You are unable to understand this material, to see the patterns that are in without actually making the first map. Only from this, your research question is transforming, is asking new questions, is giving more nuances, seeing the patterns, dynamics, maybe historical development, maybe spatial changes. And this is why the maps are so much richer. And then the analysis of the map can tell us so much more.
Yeah. Well, this sounds like a great way of concluding, in a sense, our conversation on the atlas. Before we end, though, I wanted to ask you what are you working on now? What is next for you,
Waldemar?
Now I am working on an atlas of mountain in Poland, in South Poland, which was called Giant Mountains, or in Polish Karkonosze, or in German Riesengebirge. It's a part, the highest part of Sudeten.
Okay.
I hope that you know where is it.
Yeah.
Okay. And my research is historical, obviously. My new project is entitled Two Enlightenments, and this is a comparative study of Polish and Jewish Enlightenment at the end of the 18th and the beginning of the 19th century. There is a spatial and the age component into this, because one of the chapters will be on the library of the two enlightenments, but it's not only about this, it's more historical comparative study of how Polish and Jewish enlightenment coexisted in the same territory. This is kind of unique case in history that you have two national enlightenments developing at the same time, at the same territory, and how they react to each other, how they influence each other, actually. So this is my next project.
Fascinating. And it's going to be a book?
It is going to be a book. I have actually part of this book already written. I started this project many years ago, then suspended it, and now I'm returning to finish the book, really. In 2 or 3 years' time from now, I hope to have a draft manuscript of this book. Yeah.
That sounds great. Well,
Thank you.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for this conversation. I think it was really interesting, and I think it will be interesting for a lot of people. So thank you
for inviting us. It's very important for us that we can spread the word about the atlas. As you saw, we are extremely proud of this atlas, and we are always very happy to talk about it.
Yes,
thank you very much.
Thanks for joining. Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.